serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with 100-year-old Roger Jensen of Fresno, California. I mentioned that book, The Last Mission by Jim Smith. It gives you the big picture of a bombing mission on the final day of hostilities in World War II. You'll find Roger Jensen's name on page 248 of the latest edition. But even better, we get to hear in his own words and his own voice how it unfolded that day for the B-29 named Horrible Monster.
We were assigned to be in that group to fly that mission. So we put on extra fuel, and we weighed more than we ever had on any other mission. We had to reduce our bomb load to accommodate additional fuel to be able to fly that extra distance. One of the weaknesses of B-29 was the engines weren't good. And so we'd lose some planes because they just couldn't get off, just couldn't get going. And our airfield that we had on Guam was situated so that at the end of the runway, there was a cliff. And from that top of that cliff to the ocean was about 75 feet. And so we, as soon as we got to the edge, we went down, to get speed up to fly. And so we were in the number two position to take off that day. We were right behind the theater. And as we started down the runway, there was two runways we used. And there was a plane that would take off every minute on each runway. So there was a plane taking off every 30 seconds. Mm-hmm. And there was probably 125 or 50 planes destined to fly that mission. Well, we had an engine that was not operating correctly as we started down the runway, so we aborted and went back to our stand. And so we said, well, we guess we don't fly that mission. But the ground crew got it fixed. And by the time they got it fixed, the last plane that had taken off for the mission was about 15 or 20 minutes anyway. And so we asked them, do we take off or do we stay here? It's up to you. If you want to stay, okay. If you want to go, go. We said go. So we went, and so we were the last plane to take off. So we were the last plane to drop that bomb load. And that bomb load was dropped. We dropped our bombs less than an hour before Herr Hedo accepted unconditional surrender. And so we were the last plane, because of that situation of our takeoff time, to be the last plane to drop the bombs in that mission, which was the longest mission that was flown, combat mission out of Marianas in World War II. We were the last plane to drop the bomb on Japanese land. So we got word about an hour after we had dropped that bomb that Herr Hedo had accepted the surrender.
So you're on your way back. And for people to understand, when you say the longest mission, so you're going from Guam all the way to the northern end of Japan.
Which was Hokkaido was is the area. It was the last only oil-producing drilling field that Japan had. That was the reason for the mission, they said. We found out different later, but that's what they told us.
Well, there's a lot you found out later, and I want to touch on that. But so we understand how long this was. How many hours?
17 hours is the longest mission. We were 17 hours from takeoff to landing.
That's a long time. But you're on the way back from dropping your bombs, and you hear on the radio Japan has surrendered?
Yeah.
That's a pretty unique place to be to get that news.
It's a good place to be any place when you get that kind of news in that circumstances. So everybody on the crew went to sleep, except me. I never did sleep on the plane. Other people could sleep when after we dropped the planes and headed back home. It was tired. Our average mission was about 12 to 13 hours. Mm-hmm. But this one was 17. And so I just didn't feel comfortable about sleeping, and so they could always figure I'd be going. And had a wonderful crew and a flight engineer. All of our crew members were well experienced people. They weren't recruits, so it was really wonderful. You have that kind of support and ability that you had in your crew. And so anyway, that was the experience we had up to the time of surrender. Then what happened during that last mission at the Imperial Palace, we didn't know about that. That was secret information and was never divulged for 40 years. And at the end of 40 years, we were told what happened at the Imperial Palace during up to the surrender deal, that we were so effective, were part of that, not knowing it, for 40 years.
So for 40 years, you know you have the distinction of being the last crew on the last mission of the war.
Yeah.
But you don't know that without you guys flying over Tokyo, that the surrender might not have happened.
Yeah.
What did they tell you 40 years later?
Well, they didn't tell us anything. I mean, it was just made public or made available. The radio operator on my first crew wrote a book, The Last Mission, Jim Smith, and he wrote the first book on what happened on that last mission.
So help us understand the significance of that, of why the path of your mission actually affected whether or not the surrender happened.
Well, the radar system that Japan had picked up the fact that here were B-29s coming in towards Tokyo. They were afraid we were going to drop, another atomic bomb on Tokyo or on the Imperial Palace even. What they did then, they blacked out the whole area, including the Imperial Palace and so forth. All of the personnel of the Imperial Palace, including the Emperor, were in the dark, and most of them were in shelters. Herr Hayato had decided that he would accept unconditional surrender, but he never talked to these people directly. It was always recorded. He'd record, and they'd pay the recording, but he never would personally talk to these people.
Would never be a live broadcast. It was always done ahead of time.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And so the recording that was made of the surrender was done at early evening. There was a group of the high command group of Japan that didn't agree with the emperor about surrendering. They wanted to keep on going. And so they figured that if they got a hold of that recording that was down in someplace in the Imperial Palace, they could destroy that and the people wouldn't know about it. And they would hold the emperor under control, prison, I guess you'd say, or under arrest, so to speak. Being that they had to block out, there was only light they had was flashlights they could use, and they tried to find that. Often they tried to go to the radio station where it was recorded to the people, and they didn't know where it was. And others that did know didn't tell them. I mean, they just didn't tell you. So they did capture the Imperial Palace personnel and imprisoned them, separated them out so that his message wouldn't go out to his people. Well, there was two groups, and so the group that wanted to surrender were strong enough to avoid the other group that wanted to keep on under control. So they lost their support, and the leaders of that committed suicide at that point. So at daybreak, shortly thereafter, I believe, the recording was put out, and it was unknown whether the people would accept what the emperor said. And one of the conditions that the surrender did offer was that Herr Hayato would not be killed. But anyway, he made they played the recording, and the people of Japan accepted what he said. Just amazing how he could control those many people of something that was so adverse to what he was asking them to do.
Yeah, because up till then, it had been an honor to die for the emperor.
Yeah, that's right.
He was a divine figure.
Afterwards, we found out they had a lot of kamikaze planes that they had stored. Some of these people just thought they could beat us with those kamikazes. And interestingly enough, years later, when I was out of the service and in business and selling merchandise that I'd raised in Japan, I was dealing with a person over there when I was over there selling citrus. We talked a little bit about that until the surrender. So he says, well, I was a kamikaze pilot.
Really?
Yeah, and here was a guy just like you and I were sitting and doing business with, nice guy. And I says, how come you would agree to that? He says, that was an honor to die. He says, there's no question of you. You just don't turn that down. Anyway, back to the surrender. It was totally accepted. There wasn't an active resistance to the Emperor's surrender.
But if we add it all up, if you and all those other B-29s hadn't been flying that mission, which some people might say, hey, it was unnecessary, they're already going to surrender, you don't need to get that oil field.
Okay.
But if you didn't, those guys might have been successful in stopping the recording from being played, right?
Could have been, yeah. And Russia was supporting Japan, and yet Stalin was with Churchill and Truman, and Russia wanted, in the spoils of the thing, to have part of Japan, particularly up the areas where we, up in northern Hokkaido. But we didn't know that. We found that out later. But that's the reason that we had that mission, was to keep Russia from getting that when we knew that Japan was going to surrender. We didn't want Russia to have that property up there.
So it wasn't so much to take the oil away from the Japanese, it was to keep the Russian, the USSR's hands off of it.
Yeah. Well, and off of the land.
Right.
See, they owned up to it. They were just going to expand their ownership of properties.
When you learned all of this 40 years later about that unknown consequence of that last mission, was that kind of mind-blowing for you?
Yeah, it was. It made sense to us after they told us about that. But we had no idea about why that happened. So that was, there was nothing heroic about that. It was just part of the deal.
Well, you've been a part of a lot of history, haven't you?
It was a good trip.
I'm looking over here at a big sign that says, Happy 100th Birthday, Roger. Did you ever think, growing up, that you're going to be 100 years old?
No way. No way. I thought, boy, if I ever got to be 80 years old, I thought that would really be something.
And you didn't just make it to 100. Everybody can still hear how sharp your memory is, how able you are. You come to the office to keep up with work, and I'm pretty sure you drive yourself here, right?
Yes. Oh, I'm still driving, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not as sharp as I used to be, no question about that, but I'm able to function adequately to satisfy my needs, and so I'm very thankful for the good Lord giving me the years that I'm having, and so grateful for life.
When you got out of the military, you built a career in agriculture and developing property, real estate, and you're still at it at age 100.
I was fortunate that I had met some people that I associated with and started farming. I didn't have any money, but I would farm for people that did have the money that had the properties. And so out of that situation, with having some good people that I associated myself with, we established S&J Ranches, and at that time we got to where we developed. We were one of the largest farmers of citrus and pistachios in the area, and we were the largest producers of olives of anybody in the United States. And we didn't own those properties. We, like I say, we farmed them, but we were farming, and I planted lots of acreage to trees. I had a big nursery, grew good nursery trees, and then I built the first processing plant for pistachios that I sold to Sitton. I operated 3 citrus packing houses, one in Clovis, one in Exeter, and one in Tarabella. I've been fortunate to have, lucky to be with people that were good people. It was so nice from that standpoint. And I was pretty conservative. I didn't want to go into debt.
Mm-hmm.
I should have, but I didn't. But I'm okay.
Well, I know you're better than okay. And I've always been struck by the humility with which you carry yourself, given all your accomplishments. And I know you wouldn't say it, so I'll say it, but you've been very generous to your alma mater, and you've donated in significant amounts to Fresno State, specifically the Jordan College of Agricultural Science and Technology. The reason I bring that up is I'm curious why that was important to you.
When I went to Fresno State, I had to pay. My parents didn't pay the tuition. I had to work. So with that background, when my wife was still alive, she and I donated a fund and established what was called the Jensen Scholars. The earnings of that foundation provides full scholarship for eight students, full scholarship for eight students each year. And they had to be ag students. The decision to make each year as to who to award those scholarships to, I wanted the real world to be part of that. So I said we'd have seven people, three from a faculty, three from the real world, and a member of my family. I was denied a lot of activities when I went to college because I had to work.
Right.
So I figured if these guys didn't have to work because they had a scholarship, then they could participate in the fullest academically and socially in a college environment.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the reason that I did that. And to be eligible for one of these scholarships, they have to be majored in ag business or plant pathology in the ag school.
You would probably have some perspective on this because you've been around farming longer than most people have been alive. Is there something that you think the average person doesn't understand or misunderstands about farming?
Yes. I don't think that the general public appreciates the work ethic that the Mexican people have. They come in here and they will work where our people won't do it. Like I said, I've had a world of experience of all kinds of situations.
Well, I think for most people that would make this question difficult, but maybe not for you. As you hit 100 years old and you look back over a whole century of life, is there something that you look at and you say, that's what I'm most proud of or most thankful for?
Well, I'm thankful for my wife and my family.
Were there some people that you got to know in the war that didn't come home, that are folks that you still think about every once in a while?
Yeah, my roommate, Mel Rao.
And he was your roommate at Fresno State, and he was a big football star at Fresno State.
Oh, yeah.
I've seen his Distinguished Flying Cross citation. He was a B-25 pilot down in North Africa and Italy, I believe. And so he was killed in a plane crash, right?
He was on a pleasure mission, a weekend excursion to get some candy or ice cream or something.
Here he is, he's a college football player. If I go talk to some college football players right now, I don't think they would identify with that experience of a year later being flying in the war. When you got that news that had happened to him, a guy that you used to live with, how did that affect you?
Well, you just had to accept it. It was part of the deal, and it's just too bad that a good person like that, he was a good person.
So when I asked you, were there guys that you knew, that was the first one you thought of was Mel Rao?
Yeah.
One of the 406,000 Americans who died in that war. How should we remember those guys all these years later?
I think we should respect our freedom and honor their lives. I don't have much sympathy for people that don't honor our country and freedom.
The latest to join the ranks of the centenarians, Roger Jensen, an example and an inspiration to many. That's all the time we have on Hometown Heroes today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.